very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a beautiful fall Monday here in the Allstate Showcase Studio along Michigan Avenue. On Mondays, that's when the Inno boys come by. Will Flanagan is the general manager. Jim Dahlke is the ace reporter for Chicago. Inno, welcome to you both.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks so much.
And, you know, we talk about technology, innovation. There's a lot to discuss. But before we do that, really, we have to address
the most important story of the day.
Cam Newton, because Dahlke is a North Carolina fan. And we were talking, and Will said something, because if you haven't seen it, Cam Newton had on just an outrageous sort of Mad Hatter looking outfit.
It was a costume.
It was a costume.
It was ridiculous.
Listen, Cam Newton can wear whatever he wants. He was MVP last year. He's best quarterback in the league. Had a rough game, but his outfit has nothing to do with his play on the field.
I love the Cam, but Flanagan says...
No, you need to. You need a winner's outfit and you need a loser's outfit. If you're going to go loud, you go loud on the wins. Because when you look so insane after a loss, you start thinking, oh man, maybe he should have been...
He's a little comic book.
Listen, no matter what happens on the field, Cam is a winner. He's dressed like a winner. I'm okay with it.
I think you got to have a loser outfit plan.
I think you do. Maybe just maybe
you're wearing a loser outfit.
A hair shirt or a monk's robe.
Listen, if I woke up like a winner like Cam, I would wear that Mad Hatter hat.
Okay, let's talk cable because,
all right, here we go.
You know, I've had some issues with my Comcast cable recently where I'm trying to watch Netflix or Amazon on TV and I get the insufficient bandwidth and went round and round. Finally got a new modem. I drilled through walls to put an Ethernet cable in. But now you're telling me that there's this Layer 3 TV is coming into and they think they can compete with Comcast?
Yeah, Layer 3 TV is a startup just a few years old here now. It's based out of Denver, and they just launched Chicago to be really a Comcast alternative. This is not the cord-cutting alternative that you hear from a lot of people. Like Sling TV is an example of an online-only live TV service. This is sort of full cable. It's a hard-top box that sits on your TV stand, and you get around 200 HD channels, very much a competitor to Comcast, where they say they're different. Is a customer service. They say they're boasting customer service. The appreciation rates for customers of Comcast, I think, are probably as low as they've ever been, and just sort of cable in general. So they're kind of taking a customer first approach there. The price is about the same between like $80 and $150. So you're not going to change a whole lot on price, but they can give you a lot of different options when it comes to incorporating your Twitter feed, your Facebook feed, your Netflix or Hulu. And they have an algorithm, kind of like how your Netflix algorithm shows you what shows to watch next. They do that with just TV shows in general across the spectrum of cable.
Yeah, and this is a good example of innovation versus invention. So streaming and this cord cutting, that's invention. We're creating a new thing to deliver this service, to deliver this product. And I'm not sold on it because, like you were alluding to, Steve, fix the buffering and then let's talk cord cutting.
Right,
I've never streamed anything without a little bit of interruption. So before we get there, before we get to the digital revolution, let's make sure the tech works. Where this is innovation is it's taking that box set system and just improving it. It's improving it by adding customer service around it, repackaging the marketing, and dressing it up a little bit. So we're not creating anything new. We're just improving upon an existing
product.
Okay,
so is the signal going to come into my house through the existing cable? Does Comcast own that, or how does it work?
Right, so it'll work with the Comcast internet, and it'll have a hard top box. So it's pretty much just like any other sort of...
So I'm still going to be paying Comcast something?
For internet. So, yes.
Okay.
So, this is just a cable service,
so
not the internet.
Okay.
So, yeah,
okay.
And so it's 4K compatible. So they are having some different tech upgrades, but basically it's just cable.
I get it. So Comcast already is coming into my house for internet, and this would be like me watching Amazon on my TV. I'd just be going through this.
Exactly.
Instead.
Right. And so they're launching in Chicago as their first full city major rollout. It's a
backed Well, that's a big thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So this is a big test for
Right.
Them.
And it's backed by a former Motorola veteran who grew up in Northbrook, I believe. And they've got about almost $100 million in funding just in a couple of years here. So they're really trying to expand across the U.S. and provide a different alternative to Comcast.
It's Layer 3 TV. So if someone's listening and they want to just give it a try, can they just give it a try?
Give it a try and let us know. Hit us up at Chicago, and we'd love to hear what you think.
Or better yet, just have us over.
Yeah,
right?
We'll watch.
Make some food. We can watch Shark Tank.
Yeah.
Right? Well, I'll go over and watch Shark Tank, because there's always Chicagoans on that show.
That is true. And this Friday, we had another Chicago success story on Shark Tank. And this is now, we're starting to get on a roll here. We've had Spikeball, Dude Wipes, one of your favorites,
yeah.
Steve, Dude Wipes. Luna Lice, Rent Like a Champion, Pack Back.
You could have just said it once, but go ahead.
Dude Wipes was one. Did I miss Dude Wipes? Dude Wipes.
Four or five.
Six. And now Rethink, which is a startup from a Naperville teen, Trisha Prabhu, just accepted a joint $100,000 offer from Mark Cuban and Lori Greiner in exchange for 20% of the company. Another success. And what Rethink does, it's a technology, it's platform to make students rethink about this stuff they're about to put out to the web.
She's a teenager, right?
She's a teenager. A real kind of local rock star. This site in tech has been awarded a number of times, and this was a nice kind of public showcase for her.
Yeah, so basically what it is, it's an app that really is all about anti-bullying and stopping cyberbullying. So basically you download this app, and it acts as a smart keyboard for your phone. So it's a lot of schools are using it to get their students to kind of stop bullying. And basically what it does is it alerts you in real time when it thinks you're about to send a sort of mean message to somebody, and it sends you an alert, says, whoa, hang on, are you sure you want to send this message?
So it's like drunk texting for middle schoolers.
Yeah. I don't know if that's the branding that they would put around it, but no. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty close, right? So it's like, it's basically sending, as you're typing a message before you're hitting send, it kind of recognizes like, whoa, this language is kind of offensive to the person you're sending it to. And so schools, I think over a million students in Michigan are using it within their schools. Their schools kind of direct the students to download the app, and then they're using it to sort of prevent cyberbullying.
And it works, Steve, and that's what's really cool about it. It kind of sounds like such a simple idea. You almost dismiss it. But the studies have found over 93% of the adolescents who are using it, they change their minds and decide not to post a hurtful message. So it really is like, this is doing good. If 90% of the time these millions of students are saying, you know what, that's probably not a good thing to put out there, you know, one of those messages not existing on the internet makes a real difference.
Right.
So that's a good product.
And so I made the little joke about drunk texting. This is different in that drunk texting is time of day when you're texting, right? This one is actually reading, in a way, what you're writing.
Exactly, and it's across like, all your platforms. So it's like working on the keyboard on your phone, whether it's your text messages, whether it's a Facebook post, or there's a Twitter post, pretty much whatever you're typing with on the keyboard on your phone.
All right, so that is, and it's called?
Rethink.
Rethink. Okay, we'll check out. And is that something, we can download that and pay for it now?
Yeah, on the App Store.
All right, maybe I'll do that to when we exchange our texts.
Have you been bullying a lot, Steve?
I feel as if you've been bullying me today a little bit, so I was hoping maybe I'll buy it and gift it for you.
I'll just get you some Dude Wipes.
When we come back, Will Flanagan, because of that, is going to tell us the meaning of the word akistic here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Jill. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It is 12:22 Monday afternoon. On Mondays, we talk with the boys from Chicago. Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke are in the studio, and I know you stuck around after that tease from the last segment to hear Will give the definition of the word akistic. Can you please use it in a sentence, Will?
Yeah, well, in a sentence. Here, I'll give you the definition, and then I'll go in a sentence. So let me get my dictionary voice. So akistic, the science dealing with human settlements and drawing on the research and experience of professionals in various fields as architecture, engineering, city planning, and sociology. In application, conclusions are drawn aimed at achieving harmony between the inhabitants of a settlement and their physical and socio-cultural environments.
That's all nice, right. Will, but really less like a dictionary, more like Timothy Turtle, a kid I grew up.
I know. I guess that's my dictionary voice. I need to work on that one.
But my rethink would have had me pull that one back. I'm sorry.
Yeah, akistics is the it's the relationship between you and your city, between you in your physical environment, and building that harmony. And the reason why we're talking about this is because there's a new venture firm called Akistic Ventures that is focused on doing just that, on investing in technology and companies that improve cities.
Right, and it's founded by a couple of familiar names in the tech and civic scene in Chicago. David Spielfogel, the ex-Emmanuel advisor, one of the top guys of Emmanuel's campaign, left.
The Rum Whisperer?
Exactly, left a few months ago. It's sort of rumored that he was going to be doing something within tech and startups, and he is launching this firm with Brett Goldstein, the former chief data officer of Chicago, also was in IT at OpenTable and a Chicago cop for four years.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
And the former mayor of Philadelphia, right? Michael Nutter's involved.
So he's involved involved in the program as, in the venture as well. And so, yeah, they've raised $15 million, and they are going to be investing in startups that are really going to do exactly what Will was saying, improving cities.
And so this is a little bit like what's – we've talked before. I've talked briefly about these guys, but about the array of things. Is that what it's called, right? The program that's set up in Chicago. Are these connected?
You know what? They very well could be. They haven't said that officially, but I mean, there's going to be a ton of data and information around how the city of Chicago works. They're not Chicago specific. Right. I mean, they could invest in Chicago companies, but this is a national VC firm.
But that's, I'm glad you brought that up. That's exactly it. So when you say like, okay, they're investing in technology and improve cities. All right. What is that? The array of things is exactly something that they would invest in. This is nodes planted throughout the city that help us make better, smarter decisions.
It's kind of an exciting thing that cities are becoming smart, that they're using this technology to become smarter about things, and these guys will help lead the way about that. Yeah. Before we're gone, though, I want to talk about your meetup about food, the food.
Yeah, you know, Food Inno on Wednesday, on this Wednesday, the 28th. Listen, you know, if you like listen to us on Mondays, you'll like hanging with us. you know, we got a really cool event. If you like food, you like innovation, this is Food Inno. We're talking to entrepreneurs, startups, tech companies that are working at every level of the food supply chain. So we have a startup that's doing on-demand food delivery. We also have people who are bringing virtual reality to retailers to kind of rethink the shelves. So anything involved with food, any innovator in the city, we're going to have them there. It's going to be a lot of fun.
It looks very cool. And this is obviously a restaurant town. Is becoming a technology town, right? So is there some synergy here when it comes to these two?
Yes, definitely. I think what you're seeing, too, is a lot of people who are national companies and startups that are doing food delivery, for example, need to be in Chicago. We saw founders in the Valley just the other week who launched in Chicago because they needed to be in Chicago in the middle part of the country.
And so I was just looking at my wife made this really cool almond flour flatbread yesterday. And you've got a company here. What it's called?
Simple Mills. I wouldn't be surprised if it was from Simple Mills. So the keynote of the event is this panel featuring some of Chicago fastest growing food startups. Simple Mills is one of them. Limitless Coffee, which is a new coffee brand started by Matt Mattress, who is the co-founder of Protein Bar, which you see around. RX Bar, which is this great nutrition bar. So we're going to be talking to them. You know, like food startups and tech startups, they're not the same, but there's a lot of similarities. You know, they got to scale it the same way, and they have different challenges like supply. And it will be really curious to see how, you know, how they overcome those challenges and how they think like a tech company.
Yeah, there are a lot of people here I'd like to hear from, including Plant Chicago. Mm-hmm. Explain that for me very quickly, what Plant Chicago is.
Yeah, so Plant Chicago is based out of this huge space in the back of the Yards neighborhood. And they're almost like, they're like 1871, but for operations organizations tech that helps, you know, make food more sustainable in urban environments. So they're doing a lot of things, a lot of programs. They even have like a microbrewery launching in their space. So if it's a way to get food more sustainably sourced in urban environments, they're working on it.
It's kind of funny because they're probably near the side of the old stockyards that where sustainability wasn't necessarily an issue, left us with Bubbly Creek and all of that.
Disruption. Right,
where do people find more information about this?
Check us out at Chicago Inno, and if you want to just kind of engage with us every day, we have a daily newsletter called The Beat.
You do, and it's cool. Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke from Chicago Inno. People can read more about these stories at Chicago Inno as well. Thanks for coming by, guys.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, have a great event. This is the Business Lunch.
Talking baseball, Klazuski Campanella talking.
37. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Kim Gordon, thanks very much. Simi Lipman is in the studio, and I don't know what to say. I just held a baseball bat in my hand that was worth $500,000. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's Shoeless Joe Jackson's bat.
Simeon, welcome to the Business Lunch. We're here to talk about this Christie's auction, which takes place in, what, next month?
That's right, New York City, okay. October 19th and 20th at Christie's.
But there's a little. You're the roadshow guy. There's a little bit of a roadshow here with some of these items.
That's right, yeah. We're at the JW Marriott for Conversations with Christie's, which is a kind of jointly branded type of roadshow, if
right.
you will. And I've got about 30 pieces here on display.
And so you brought in the, I feel bad for the people going to see things now. I've got the bat. so that bat would have been used, what, in the
1917 to 1920 era, so his White Sox days.
Yeah, and it's interesting holding it because the neck of it is much thicker, I think, than baseball bats we grew up with.
Right? Yeah, yeah, you'll notice that with older bats, kind of like war clubs, these things.
And so you're all about collectibles and that. What makes a bat from 1919 worth $600,000?
Well, it's who it's attributed to, obviously. And in this case, you know, when you're dealing with a legendary player like Shoeless Joe Jackson, you know, that's where the value really starts. And the fact that, you know, this is one of only two known that he actually used during his playing career.
Right.
So, you know, that makes it very special.
There's only one aluminum bat that I used when I was in Little League in 1972.
Well, you got to get the, fans to bid on that one.
Do you got room? Is there room to put in the exhibit?
Yeah.
This stuff comes from, tell me about some sort of online museum. Or didn't
Yeah, it's selections from the National Pastime Museum, which is an online museum based on one individual's personal collection. So this entire collection of nearly 500 pieces belongs to one.
That's what I didn't understand. I thought it was some sort of collaboration. So one person owns all of this, mm-hmm. and they're selling it now.
That's right.
I suppose the auction house doesn't answer the question about why would they be selling it?
Well, actually, the National Pastime Museum actually put out a statement and said that, you know, this has been enjoyable to put together, but now it's time to kind of share this with the world, you know. And a lot of collectors who deal with giant collections like this reach a point where they're like, you know what, I've done it, and now, you know,
other
people
can,
yeah.
I mean, I suppose maybe it's like a family restaurant or business. When you reach a certain age, it's time to pass some inheritance on to your kids or your grandkids.
I think there's something to that, yeah.
So it's Shoeless Joe Jackson, White Sox bat. I would imagine there's some, well, I would hope, you know, that we're talking about the Cubs in the playoffs here this week. I would hope there's some Cubs memorabilia as well available.
Oh, yeah, there's amazing Cubs stuff. I brought some in the studio with me as well for show and tell. We've got Joe Tinker, Tinkers, Devers to Chance.
Right. It's Evers.
Evers. It's Evers. Everyone thinks it's Evers. But we know this because we have a another piece here, a signed questionnaire that Johnny Evers handwrote. And in it, he says very clearly that it's Evers, not Evers.
Right. Tinkers to Evers to Chance. Doesn't quite have the same ring, but that's his bat, right?
This is Joe Tinker's bat.
Okay. But again, you can see with just that bat, the neck has become a little bit more narrow, mm-hmm. which would have been, what, 30 years later, 40 years later?
No, actually, this one's probably a little earlier. So, you know, some, you know,
oh,
just like today,
wrong.
You
okay.
know, some guys, you know, they would customize their bats the way they liked them.
Okay, so this auction is coming up. People can go and look at the information now. The Shoeless Joe Jackson bat is the most expensive?
Yes, it's the most expensive item in the sale.
What that's for sale has sort of, what surprises you? Like, oh, I didn't realize this would be here. I didn't realize this would be valued at this.
Well, you know, doing this a long time, I think the thing that surprised me most is just the amount of quality material in this collection. It's kind of astounding. One of the more interesting pieces, I think, is a piece we actually have at the Marriott, which is a bill of sale. Shoeless Joe Jackson, again, selling his cigar store and pool room to his teammate Lefty Claude Williams for $1 and all, you know, all debt.
Right.
And what's really neat about this thing is that Shoeless Joe actually signed it, and he was illiterate. So he didn't like signing things. He could do it, but he didn't do it often. His wife usually signed things for him.
Uh-huh.
But this is an actual legal document which he had to sign. So that's one of the coolest pieces.
I suppose that raises the question of authenticity. A lot of Howard Hughes wills, a lot of things like that.
Sure.
How do you gauge the authenticity of these items?
Well, you know, luckily, there's something called provenance. You know where these pieces are coming from.
Chain of evidence in police work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that really helps. Obviously, a lot of experience dealing with these items. And we live in an age of specialization. There are people who, you know, specialize in, you know, bat authentication and signature.
Is that right? Really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the collector himself was very much attuned to all that and dealt with all that.
So that was then and is available now. How about the players playing now? I mean, well, let's talk about the Cubs, because they could have a World Series team for the first time, you know, in decades and decades, and maybe a winning team for over 100 years. What should we be hanging on to? What should we be stealing from Anthony Rizzo?
Well, I mean, look, this day and age, you know, people collect everything and they keep everything. You know, limited editions, everyone holds on to it. Look for the stuff that people aren't telling you to hold on to. You know, the reason baseball cards, you know, from the 50s are worth something is because there's not enough supply for the demand.
Right.
And that's because moms actually did throw their kids' cards away. You know, today everyone's holding on to everything. You know, everything's going to be worth something in the future. Look for things that people aren't telling you that about and hold on to that.
So any baseball card after the 70s is kind of not worth much.
Right now, it's hard. I mean, you're starting to see certain things move, but, you know, it's generational. So, you know, 30 years after the fact, that's when the kids start getting nostalgic and, you know, want to pay money for
it. Well, so it's an interesting thing because there are, you know, balls that are the 500th home run or the 3,000th hit or whatever that have an instant value. And then there are items that sort of cook and simmer for decades and have a greater value, right? How do you know the difference? Or tell me the difference between them.
Well, you know, it really depends. I think rarity has a lot to do with it. Condition. Like, for example, we have an Ernie Banks rookie card. Now, yeah. There are thousands and thousands of Ernie Banks rookie cards out there. But the reason this one is worth $30,000 to $40,000...
Every time you give me something, Simeon, I put my coffee away. Yeah, right. I'm holding this card now.
Well, it's because this one is graded Mint 9. And what they do these days is there are authentication and grading companies that encapsulate cards and give them a grade like 1 to 10.
Right.
And because this is a 9 and the card's from 1954 and they're just very, very scarce in that condition, it's worth $30,000 to $40,000.
It's beautiful. All right. So, well, how did you get this gig? How did you become this guy?
I was very fortunate. I've been doing this for a long time, and I've been working with Christie's for years doing pop culture sales.
But, I mean, just in general, the pop culture thing, how does someone arrive at that?
Well, I mean, for me, it was I've been doing it since I was a kid. You know, it was something I found very interesting, and I kind of just followed it here.
Simeon Lipman is talking about the Christie's auction. People can find more items at the JW Marriott. That's at Adams, on Adams for today and tomorrow, right?
That's correct.
And then follow the auction, comes up October 19th and 20th.
That's right. And you can go to Christie's.com and, you know, it's all there and you can check out the catalog and it's really spectacular.
So you brought in some very nice things here. Some of them are smaller than others. Did you count them coming in?
Yeah.
So you'll count them going out, right?
Yeah.
All right. Just wanted to know ahead of time. Thanks. It was nice to talk to you.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. You know, big debate is tonight, and they're talking about 100 million people watching. I don't know how that audience is going to measure, how long the audience will stay with it, but this is the big one. The first debate is usually the most watched, and the race seems to be very tight, so there's a lot riding on it. Scott Kleinberg joins us each week to talk about social media. And, well, Scott, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thank you very much, Steve.
I want to focus on that a little bit. Now, you write about the fact that Instagram will be involved tonight, CBS, and all of these different networks are trying to harness social media in a variety of ways.
Yep.
And it's important because of the millennial vote, right? Because they may well be engaging in the debate through some of these social media outlets.
Definitely. And you know what, Steve? It used to be that we would sit there, we'd have this conversation, and we would say, well, it's either going to be Twitter or Facebook where people are watching. And that was true for a very long time. And like you were saying before, that's not the case anymore. We have Twitter, we have Facebook, we have YouTube, we have Instagram stories, we have Snapchat. And it goes to all the things that you were saying, that there's different audiences, people trying to market to different segments, and that's going to make a huge difference.
Yeah, and Hillary Clinton has had trouble with millennials, and so she needs to register with them in one way or another. Do you suppose the candidates' answers or approach to debate will be altered by to whom she's trying to appeal via which media? I mean, I just wonder if this is going to be a social media debate.
I don't know if it's going to turn into that. I think there's just so much at stake in general. I think that's always going to be on people's minds. But everything that we've been talking about, you know, for the longest time has been fact-checking. And whose job is it to fact-check? Is it the moderator? Is it not? I think they'll probably, and I hope, to see some questions being sourced off of social media so people's voices are heard. I just don't know if it's going to necessarily turn into a social media debate. But hopefully, you know, there's more than one debate. Hopefully there's opportunity for that.
Well, I suppose that fact-checking and all of that will be coming up on social networks.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely, I mean, that's what you're going to be seeing people talking about tonight. And I just read something a little while ago saying that Bloomberg and their coverage, that they are going to actually fact check live on the screen as it's happening. And I wasn't clear if that meant the TV channel or the web or whatever, but I think that's really going to be a central part of this, whether, you know, Donald Trump wants people to fact check or Hillary Clinton does or doesn't. I don't think that's going to matter in this case. Everybody is going to be all over that.
All right. So that's that tonight. I want to talk as well about Uber, because, you know, I hadn't thought about the fact that you may well engage with an Uber driver. You get the picture when you choose the ride. They come to you, but maybe that picture doesn't match the actual driver because, you know, they're taking a break and they have their sister-in-law driving for them or something like that. Uber's trying to fix that.
Yeah, they're implementing a system where they're going to ask drivers to sign in via selfie. And it sounds, you know, we hear the word selfie and we just think, oh, selfies are cute and they're fun. And in this case, they're really more helpful than anything else. So the way I understand it's going to happen is a driver is going to get in the car and they're going to say, okay, we need to know that this is actually you. Their system works where it goes online with their computer, and that's how they're able to get rides and do all these things. So without their login, they wouldn't be able to do much under the system. And the way this works, there's a selfie that would be taken. The photo is already stored through some sort of Microsoft thing in the cloud, and it would match back and say, okay, this is you, and it would log on. And they're looking into doing this when the drivers start their shifts. Also, just randomly, just, you know, at some point just a driver's sitting and waiting, and they're like, we just need to make sure it's you, so, you know, just smile for the camera type of thing.
Has there been a problem with non-Uber drivers driving Uber cars?
No, I don't think that's it. I think the thing is there's been so many complaints and so many concerns about safety and things that have happened, and it's just any rideshare, you know, Uber's one, but, you know, there's other companies too. I think they're just trying to be extra proactive in making sure. One of the other things they mentioned in that same story when they talked about that is they're also doing things to track things that are happening during the ride. So when drivers brake too hard or when drivers, you know, constantly speed up really fast and they're too fast, you know, that kind of feedback is coming back to Uber and saying, okay, you got a driver who's doing this. So all put together, I think those are really smart things.
Okay, so, you know, I was just going through my technology drawer before the show started, and there were my Google glasses.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't used them very much, and maybe I'll buy Snapchat's version, or what, they're coming out with Snapchat glasses now?
Yes, and I would highly recommend them because I think they're smart and I think you look very stylish in them.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. But Snapchat glasses, I think, are such a smart thing. They are what Google Glass is not. Google Glass was $1,500. You had to get on a waiting list. They tried to do too many things at once. Snapchat glasses are plastic-looking glasses. Even the guy, the CEO, called it a toy. And it basically shows everything that you see around you in 115-degree field. So it's circular. It's not landscape. It's not vertical like you hear all the time with video. It's circular. It's more natural. And basically, they're affordable. It's $130. They look like they're $130. They're kind of, you know, plastic-looking. They have a light on the rim that shows you when you're being recorded. Basically, everything that Google Glass did wrong, this is the opposite. And I think it's going to resonate really well with young people. I think you're going to see a lot of these glasses on come the holiday season.
All right, so we got to go real quick here. But so you just sort of tap the hinge and it records for a few seconds and then tap it again or whatever, and it's posted up on your feed.
Yep, it connects via Wi-Fi and it works 10 seconds just like a Snapchat video does. And they're supposed to come in like three different colors. I think they're going to be fashionable. I think you're going to see people taking selfies in them. And I think you're going to be seeing a lot of this 115-degree video, whatever that ends up being called.
And I think you're going to have a pair before the week is over.
I think you're probably right about that.
Scott Kleinberg, great to talk to you again. I appreciate it.
Great to talk to you, Steve.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN.